Kia ora tātou and welcome to this Asia Insight from the Asia New Zealand Foundation, Te Whitu Tohono in Wellington. I'm Graham Acton. Today I'm joined by Dr. Reuben Abraham. Reuben's the CEO of Arthur Global, a policy and research organisation based in Mumbai and London. He's a noted expert on India's economic development and is currently a senior fellow at the New York University's Marin Institute, an Asia fellow at the Milken Institute in Singapore, and an honorary advisor to the Asia New Zealand Foundation. He was also awarded Think Tanker of the Year by Prospect magazine in London in 2021 for his work on the COVID crisis in India. I caught up with Reuben during a recent visit to Wellington for a discussion on India's economic future, its digital transformation, and its relationship with New Zealand. I began by asking him how he saw India's economic development in 2024.
I think given everything that happened during the pandemic, I think India is doing reasonably well. The GDP numbers shows, if I remember correctly, 7.3 to 7.4% growth, which I think, you know, if you look around the world and look at the stagnation in many parts of the world, is quite remarkable, those kind of numbers. And I mean, keeping in mind that the Americans grew at 5% plus. So I think overall, it's fairly positive in India. I think there's some distributional questions that need to be asked and so on. But macro, big picture, India doing well. The other thing that India is doing well on is geopolitically, which is that given the China plus one strategy that the West seems to be adopting, this model of de-risking that, again, a lot of countries seem to be thinking about, I think all of that leaves a plenty of room for India to occupy. So I think both economically and geopolitically, India sees itself in a very, very sweet spot. Now, the question is whether India can actually capitalize on the opportunity and do what is required.
So elections, all of the pundits and all of the signals really are for another victory for Modi and the BJP. Mm-hmm. At what point do you think the BJP will plateau in its power, if you know what I mean? It seems to me it's able to achieve more and more in the electoral system of India, mm-hmm. because mm-hmm. it builds coalitions with all sorts of parties that you would think would not really be wanting to build a coalition.
Right.
Is it the coalitions that will control in the end the BJP, or do you think the BJP will just become even more dominant in the future?
I think it's two things. I think what the BJP has done masterfully politically is to break down earlier, before the 2014 elections and so on, caste was the primary driver in an election. But I think the BJP, not entirely successfully, but they've had a fair bit of success on this, which is to create an identity that actually supersedes the caste identity, and that is the Hindu identity, right? So they've managed to consolidate the Hindu vote very, very effectively. And I think that is a political masterstroke that they've managed to pull off. But look, at the end of the day, that alone would not have given him the sort of majorities that he has. The prime minister still enjoys approval ratings north of 75%, right? I mean, 10 years into a term, if a political leader is enjoying 75% approval, and this is not Saddam Hussein's 90% approval ratings, this is real approval ratings from people, it basically means he must be doing something right. And I think what he's actually getting right is on the welfare front. And the delivery of services to people and so on have just improved dramatically. And I think the biggest testament to that is just look at the way women are voting. I mean, I think the real interesting bit in the BJP story is how many women have started to vote for the BJP, which seems unusual because, you know, typically the fans of right-wing parties tend to be male, not female. But in India's case, you actually see a lot more women showing up to vote for the BJP. And I suspect that is because really, their lives have improved, is my guess.
One of the other things he's done is the digital transformation of India, which has impressed his enemies even.
So I think a little bit of backstory here, which is that the initial idea for all of this did not come from him. Right. It actually came from the previous government and people in the previous government. In fact, in 2014, Mr. Modi ran on a platform that said that he was going to shut down the biometric ID platform. What is remarkable about the man, though, is once he realized, and you know, this was actually explained to him, that this entire digital infrastructure that was planned could actually turbocharge his agenda, he actually turned his he turned on a dime there and basically said, rather than shut it down, he said he was going to massively accelerate it. And so the build out across payments, education, biometric ID, all of this has dramatically changed people's lives. I mean, you know, the simple example of this is if you just look at the payments piece of this, right? I mean, and so there's one piece of payments is the consumer. But let's just look at small business, right? I think the entry barriers for small business to participate in the digital economy has gone up so dramatically. Because earlier, if you look at point of sale devices in India, there were probably about 7 to 8 million point of sale devices. In 4 years, there's about 60 to 70 million QR codes in operation, right? And that shows the level of inclusion that is possible just for SMEs. Then there's the inclusion on the consumer side, which is also quite dramatic. And at this point, it's just payments. But now there's these conversations around, can you layer credit onto it? Can you layer insurance onto it? Because you now have really good data exhaust that's coming out of these transactions, right? I mean, so you're able to provide services to the poor. Graham, just to give you a sense of just the numbers on the consumer side, in the last month, in just 1 month, there were 12 billion real-time instantaneous payment settlements made over the Unified Payments Interface. 12 billion, right? And they're moving over $200 billion every month. Right? So this is staggering stuff that is happening.
Yeah,
this is very similar to what happened in the US in the 90s when there was a whole stack of technologies that came through the, you know, whether that's the internet, browsers, email, all of these things came out of the US. And you know, you could have called it America's stack, but at some point you realize that you need to free up these technologies.
So you've got the three aspects. You've got the digital transformation in India. You've got the ability and the competence within India to deal with outsourcing from other countries. Mm-hmm. So coming in, contracts coming into the country. Yeah. And you've also got, it seems to me, an increasing access to energy, which is renewable energy, a lot of it, and is forecast to be even more use of renewable energy in the future. All of those things seem to add up to quite a powerful launching pad, really.
Yes.
And I'm just wondering how you see that's going to play out in the next 5 years, so up to 2030 in India. You've got 7% growth now.
Yeah.
Will India do the same thing as China did, do you think?
So, and this is obviously, you know, we're talking about the future, so at best it's a prognosis. I suspect that India will not be able to do what China did, which is the 10 to 15% growth for 20 years. I don't think that's possible because every time India has gone to 10% growth, and it has done that multiple times in the past, inflation takes off, right? And inflation in a poor country is political suicide. So I think the consensus politically has been, look, it's okay to have 6 to 8% growth as long as we can keep a lid on inflation. I think that's broadly the consensus because the ability to do 10 to 15% growth while keeping inflation low requires a set of structural changes in the economy, which are politically really difficult to do, right? So I think this is kind of where we're at. But again, you know, keep in mind the fact that there are many ways in which you can get rich. Right, you can grow at 2% for 100 years or 150 years, which is the story of the West. The West grew rich through that process. You can grow at 7% per annum for 50 years and you'll get rich. Or you can grow at 15% per year and you'll get rich in 25 years, which is the East Asia story. Right? Now, I think while India has aspirations to replicate the East Asia story, I think it's a lot harder to do in a political system that East Asia did not have to deal with, right? Because almost all of East Asia basically grew under some form of authoritarian setup. So given that difficulty, which is, you know, the fact that India had democracy before it had structural transformation in the economy. So that's the problem that India needs to basically face.
And do you think it can face it? I mean, in the current system, with the current leadership, do you think it will be able to do that?
So, I mean, let's put it this way. So the sort of reforms that are required, which are like administrative reforms, judicial reforms, you know, tax reforms and so on. I mean, is it possible to do? Yes, it is possible to do because everybody knows what needs to be done. And you could argue that if there's anyone who could do it, it is Mr. Modi. But then you've also got to ask the question of he's been in power for 10 years. Right. And he has not done any of that. So maybe it is really difficult to do. And, you know, the kind of structural transformation that is required may be just hard politically.
I just want, just as a sidebar, I wondered your views on the Indian stock market. Do you think the New Zealanders should look to be investing in India in the stock market as a way of basically increasing their personal wealth in the next 5 years?
Well, I mean, let's put it this way. The Indian stock market has been going absolutely gangbusters. I mean, I'm personally invested in the Indian stock market and I've done very well. But that said, I know the market, right? So, and the I know the Indian corporate scene, I know the market. So I would not advise it for people who don't know what's going on, right? Because there's too much happening that the average Kiwi has no access to by way of information. So if you have to go there, I would absolutely say do an index mechanism or, you know, either you find some way to invest in the index itself rather than in companies and choose your timing, right? My own analysis of the Indian stock market right now is it's overvalued. Certainly do not get in at this point. But, you know, there are more and more funds now available, which actually gives you exposure to the Indian market, which obviously gives you good returns. It won't give you the sort of returns that you get if you were directly invested in the market, but you don't have anything like the same sort of risk either.
We were just talking about China there. I just wondered how you saw the relationship at the moment. It seems to be stable and a little bit edgy, but nothing like we saw sort of 2 or 3 years ago.
So, you know, the way India sees it is that China wants hegemonic power in Asia. So there is no room for India to emerge as a potential geopolitical rival to China from a Chinese perspective. And obviously from an Indian perspective, India wants to be that geopolitical, you know, certainly equal to China in Asia. So I think that's the source of the tension. To your point about whether things have stabilized, I don't think things have found an equilibrium, but I would not necessarily call it stable because certainly from India, I mean, Chinese companies are in a lot of trouble in India. You know, there are tax raids. There's all sorts of things happening with Chinese companies. TikTok was thrown out of the country and so on and so forth. So on the business side, there has been, you know, Chinese companies have been affected. But if you still look at the trade flows between the two countries, it's pretty massive, right? I mean, so in that sense, both countries do need each other. They are neighbors. They have to do business with each other. You know, it's the whole thing about you can choose your friends. You can't choose your neighbors, right? So we just have to live with what is going on in China. But I actually do think that the Chinese pushing around of India the last 5 years has certainly led to India abandoning its conventional position, which would be non-alignment, work with China, work with the US, and so on, to a system which is much more kind of in the Western camp, much more US aligned, so to speak. So, you know, the Quad has now actually become real, right? I mean, there is now talk of interoperability between the navies of these countries. There's constant military exercises between Australia, Japan, Korea, India, Vietnam. All of these people are beginning to collaborate in a big way. So I think there is something to be said about the fact that these countries are pushing back now.
Just moving on to India and New Zealand, you'll be aware that the Trade Minister, Todd McClay, is off to India in the next couple
week,
of
yeah.
days. Yes. What do you think he should be saying to them from New Zealand's point of view?
So I'll tell you what he should not be saying. And what he should not be saying to them is free trade deals. Because as I see it, it's not going to happen. Now, by the way, this again is the future. You know, you can predict anything except for the future. So who knows? Maybe a FTA will show up. But the truth is, I was in Wellington in 2010. I was giving a talk and I said, give up on the FTA. It's not going to happen. So the fact that in 2023, we're still talking about the FTA actually tells you something, because if it had to be concluded, it would have been concluded by now. The thing from an Indian perspective that I think Kiwis need to understand is the Indian view on this is, look, a free trade deal here effectively means what you're saying is you get free unfettered access to 1.4 billion people and we get free unfettered access to 5 million people, right? I mean, it just doesn't work from an Indian perspective. And that's why I think it's almost naive to keep going down the path of the trade deal. I think there is so much that can be done without the trade deal, right? And I think at some level, the trade deal is a distraction. There is so much business to be done between the two countries. You look at Israel and India, you know, the amount of cooperation in agriculture between Israel and India. And all of that happens without a trade deal, right? Because Israel is mostly talking about ag tech and so on and so forth. So again, rather than talk about agricultural produce, can we talk about agricultural technology? Even in, if you're going to talk about produce, can we talk about stuff that is less contentious than, say, dairy, right? I mean, can we talk about kiwi fruit, right? That may be places where you can actually have a conversation. But I think on technology, the digital public infrastructure. So, for instance, if New Zealand wanted to engage in a conversation about digital public infrastructure, I can virtually guarantee you the Indian government would be all over it. That's so it's right. a question of what is likely to get a relationship going in a big way. And once you are cooperating on five things, then you can say, how about we do 10 things? And so on and so forth. And that's how you build trade. And there's a lot of room for cooperation, right? I mean, besides technology, there's education. I mean, you know, the education relationship between India and New Zealand is completely underpowered. You look at tourism, again, completely underpowered. You just look at the number of Indian tourists who go to Australia versus Indian tourists who come to New Zealand. It's just not on par.
And why is that? Because we're not promoting ourselves
So there's an immense amount of goodwill towards New Zealand because, I would say primarily because of the old cricketing ties and sporting ties and so on. Every Indian's second favorite team would almost certainly be New Zealand. And this is partially because of the relationships that people like Kane Williamson have actually created. I mean, the image of New Zealand is a very, very positive one. But beyond that, there is a storytelling problem. There's a narrative problem and so on and so forth, right? So if you look at, again, like I said, I can't understand why so many Indian tourists go to Australia but not to New Zealand. In 2015, when the World Cup happened, Cricket World Cup happened in India and New Zealand, plenty of my friends went to see the World Cup. It was me and another person who were watching it in New Zealand, and everybody else was in Australia watching it. I mean, that in itself tells you, why is it that it's just me sitting in New Zealand watching the World Cup?
Yes.
So I think there is a narrative problem. Again, these are all solvable problems.
Is it a visibility problem in a way?
It is a visibility problem. Yeah. But for all of this, you know, New Zealand has to invest as well, right? To basically make the case that, okay, here are a whole bunch of ways in which we can work together. The problem is, as I see it, is a lot of this is basically seen through the lens of China. The truth is, it took a long time to get to where we are with China today. Why do you expect to get results in 10 years with India that took 40 years with China?
And also with the other, you know, the world has changed, right?
Correct.
Since that FTA was signed, it's not quite that simple anymore. As far as India's presence in New Zealand goes, with the Indian diaspora here, which is growing quite mm-hmm. rapidly and establishing itself in Auckland especially, mm-hmm. is there any perception that India, or do you see any perception in India that New Zealand is wanting to get alongside the Indian population, sort of increase the immigration, increase the educational opportunities? If we look away from just straight out commerce, have you seen any sort of build up in
it's a good question, Graham. I think if I think about US immigration versus, sorry, Indian immigration into the US versus Indian immigration into New Zealand, I think Indian immigration into New Zealand is more network based. As in, if you know, then you know. If you're part of a network, then you know, and so on. Whereas immigration to the US, for instance, happens on merit. I think that's what the big difference is. So there's an over-dependence on networks when it comes to immigration into New Zealand. Now, the problem with that is networks tend to be concentrated regionally and so on and so forth. So therefore, you are getting more and more of the same kind of person. Whereas in the US, you're getting a much wider diversity of people who are actually coming in, both regionally diverse, educationally diverse, skills-based diverse. Mm. Right? You're actually getting a very different profile of person coming in. Now, of course, this is for New Zealand to figure out, as in what is the type of migrant it wants? Not just Indian migrants, any kind of migrant. What is the sort of person that it wants and why? And that has to be thought through strategically in light of fertility numbers in New Zealand, in light of productivity numbers in New Zealand, and so on and so forth. So do you want high skills, mid skills, low skills? What's the process by which you engage and so on and so forth? That's the way I would think about it. Right now, the problem that I see, certainly as an outsider, is I don't see strategy here. And I think that's problematic. So again, when it comes to education, I just don't understand why more Indian students don't come here to study. Typically, the average Kiwi response to this is New Zealand is too far away. To which, further away than Canada? It's actually New Zealand is closer to India than Canada is. So what are we talking about here, right? I mean, so I think it is underpowered, and a lot of it has to do with narrative, visibility, and so on and so forth. We are not talking about attracting Indian students who otherwise would go to Harvard, right? There's an entire tiering of candidates here. So the question is between, so I guess my question is the top New Zealand university competitive with, for instance, the University of Iowa or the California state system? And I would argue the top universities, whether it's Victoria, Auckland, Canterbury, I think all of these places are perfectly competitive with that second tier of US universities. So no one's making the case that New Zealand is going to be able to attract away people who would otherwise go to Harvard. But it's that second tier that I'm asking about. And equally, if you'll just indulge me for a second, just to give you a sense of what is actually going on in India, right? I mean, so if you look at the top, say, commerce colleges in Delhi, if you've graduated from high school and you want to go to the top commerce colleges in Delhi, your cutoff to get in is 100%. So if you do not get 100%, you do not get in, right? That's right. The level of competition. So my argument to New Zealand education institutions is between 85% and 100% are some incredibly smart, competent kids, of whom, let's be very conservative here, of whom maybe 10% are willing to pay in dollars for that education. That's a really good space to be in. And you will actually import very good people and very good skills in the process.
I think it's the immigration field, as you probably know, in New Zealand, it's a merry-go-round, right? It's sort of open it up to everybody, then close it down, then open up. Yeah. And at the moment, it appears that we're about to go into a close it down period, which is going to create a few problems in New Zealand.
And I think, again, that goes back to the, to me at least on the outside, a lack of strategy. And also have, you know, and this is something that I suppose the Europe in particular has learned very painfully, is that you've got to have ways in which you have integration so that the immigrants coming in are not ghettoized. They actually share Kiwi values and so on and so forth. You know, this is a unique place, and you don't want to under any circumstances ruin that, right? And so there, you have to also actively be thinking about integration.
Reuben, thanks very much. That's all we've got time for today. Thank you very much. Enjoy your stay in New Zealand. We'll see you again.
Thank you very much, Graham. It's always a pleasure to be here.
That's Asia Insight. Thanks for listening. Mā te wā.